I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Stockpile water and food, gas up your car, have a bag packed. The recent hurricanes and earthquakes mean we've heard a lot of advice to keep us and our property safe. But what about our savings and investments? Today, our smart money experts offer advice to prepare your finances and your financial information should you need to turn your assets into cash as quickly as possible. Then, that 1/8-cent sales tax that Kansas Cityans passed back in April, it's aimed to improve the long-neglected East Side. We'll find out what residents are saying when it comes to spending that money in their neighborhoods. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In the wake of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, emergency preparedness is in the national consciousness these days. Today we'll discuss how a natural disaster or other emergency can impact your finances and what you should do now to prepare for just such an event. Our smart money experts are back to talk about it, and they are Sandy Weaver. She's a certified financial planner certificate with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, welcome back.
Morning, Steve.
Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners. That's located in Brookside. Barbara, nice to have you.
Good morning.
Well, we're not thinking hurricanes here in the Midwest, but maybe, what, Sandy, tornadoes or earthquakes? Because there's always something to worry about here, right?
That's true, yes.
Yeah, whether we want to worry or not, it's out there.
Yeah.
Okay. How much money should you have available, Barbara, when in case disaster hits, what should be at hand here?
Well, what most financial advisors will tell you is you should have an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months worth of regular expenses in a reserve.
Now, who does that?
Well, but reserve can be interpreted loosely. So when you're talking about an emergency, when we kind of drill down, what we would recommend is that you have maybe 2 to 3 months worth in cash, readily accessible. Other things that can be liquidated quickly, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, can become your backup. Mm-hmm. But you need that three to six months just for life in general. But for an emergency, you have to be able to grab onto it quickly. And that means you need more liquidity than you would in ordinary life circumstances.
Sandy, would a 401k qualify as money you can get your hands on quickly or not?
Normally not. And the reason I say is even if your 401k allows employee loans, usually you have to go through paperwork. So, in some cases, yeah, it can be that second tier that Barbara just referred to, but normally not.
What do the experts say about what percentage of Americans keep a reserve of 3 to 6 months cash, ready cash around? What do we know about that?
I can't imagine
it's high.
No, it's got to be very low because most people aren't prepared for retirement, much less a six-month emergency.
Right.
I don't have a statistic on it.
And that begins to speak to how many folks down in Houston, down in Florida, are in bad shape these days.
Oh, exactly. And they're suffering a catastrophic loss, which we might not see here. When you're in the Midwest, I think what you're talking about, we're talking about flooding, but of a different sort. You're talking about tornadoes. Worst case scenario would be Joplin, 2011. You're talking about ice storms. You're talking about situations that will isolate you from your assets, from the community, from your normal life for a few days, a few weeks. And then you go into kind of a recovery, which could be an extended period. But by then, the support systems are back up.
No, it used to be that people would say, well, if you're worried about ice storms and the weather, we'll just move to Florida. Well, that doesn't seem like a very good option these days. We'll just move to California. Well, with global warming, oceans rising, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Where's a safe place?
Where do you
go?
Yeah.
Where do you go?
With no earthquakes, no hurricanes, nor tornadoes.
Is there
no
such
flooding.
A place on the planet Earth any
yes.
longer? I don't know. You also recommend keeping 2 to 3 weeks worth of reserve in cash in a safe that is fireproof and waterproof. Tell us about that, Sandy.
You know, and I happen to have one of those. They're big, heavy things. I have two, actually, but it's important to have access to cash because when most of the infrastructure of your life isn't working, such as banking systems, such as the internet, cash still talks. If you have to, get to a Home Depot or if they're open, or try to barter for something that you need, say a generator or use of electricity, cash talks, and you can, you know, get enough to get by for a week, say.
Mm-hmm. And your safe is waterproof as well?
Yes, and fireproof.
Okay.
Yeah. It's big and heavy, and really it's the brand is Century. There are two or three well-known brands. You can buy them from Walmart or Target.
And what do you keep in there? What kinds of things?
Tax return, cash, obviously. I keep in legal documents, powers of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I keep passport, driver's license copies, yeah. Insurance copies.
What's a safe like that cost, just roughly?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think it was $50. You can buy them
in
different sizes.
Yeah.
They're not expensive. You know, it depends how big of one that you're going to need. But you usually, if you think about it, especially these days, it depends how much you put your data up in the cloud. But these days, you know, you don't need to have that much paper, you know, saved. So it can be a smaller kind of safe.
Barbara, do you have a safe?
No, we don't.
No.
We depend on the cloud.
Do
which
you?
Is what Sandy mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going back to the safe. I've heard some insurance agents actually recommend that you bolt the safe
yes.
to the floor. But we have found the cloud is a good alternative. So that's where we store the documents, even just for traveling. When you think about it, how practical it is when you aren't at home, when you're in a foreign country or something, and you suddenly need a copy of something. Something goes wrong. I think a good way to prepare for a storm would be to imagine that you are overseas and you suddenly need these documents. Which documents are you talking about?
And which are you talking about?
Well, Sandy mentioned driver's licenses, passports, anything that identifies you. A health insurance card
mm-hmm.
would definitely be critical. Your insurance information and who to contact there. Phone numbers. I mean, does anybody have, yeah, who remembers phone numbers anymore? Power of attorney documents. Those can be critical, especially if you're traveling. But if it's the kind of catastrophic event where you might need someone to act for your financial or your health, you would want power of attorney documents in there. Immunization records, possibly, especially for kids. If the disaster is such, and I'm thinking about Joplin in 2011, where the children may need to move to a new school district,
mm-hmm.
you would want to have those immunization records.
Oh, that's interesting.
You yeah. might also copies of the credit cards so that you can buy things.
Yes.
So you're talking about in the event you lose your passport, you lose your credit cards are stolen. It's that kind of thing we're
yes.
talking about here.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I've used it, frankly.
Have you?
Yeah, I have. I've got mine up in the cloud. And you can get, you know, two-step authentication up there, so it's pretty secure. But you can, you know, take scan and put them up there, get good copies. So.
And I've heard a lower tech method of doing that. I know people who will scan the documents and email them to themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's in their email files.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, someday I'll tell you my story about covering the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in 2016. And the first day I'm there, I thought I had lost my Secret Service credentials, which basically meant I was in a hot seat for that week and the following week in Philadelphia for the Democrats. It was not a lovely moment for about 2 hours there. And they were back in my hotel room just sitting on my desk. But I was certain I had them with me. So you don't think these things can happen, but
yeah,
they do happen,
they
don't
do.
They?
They do.
Yeah, okay. Some people even recommend keeping, you hear this talk about gold or keeping silver in your safe in the event of a catastrophic financial system collapse. What do you make of that idea, Sandy?
That's not something that we recommend, but some people do. You know, in the end, gold is better than any currency. That kind of perspective, I don't know how practical that is.
I was going to say, where would you go with the gold if the system did collapse? You don't go to Hen House and say, hey.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, they're not going to take that.
The other problem with gold is that the price can fluctuate so dramatically. So in an emergency where everybody's trying to cash in their gold, is it going to go up because it is an emergency? Is the value going to drop because everybody wants their money? I don't know how you could. It would be difficult to peg a value and know actually how much gold you need to get through. And the problem with silver is it's hard to define the value on that because it has industrial uses, too. It's not
yeah.
a pure store of value.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
I'm wondering what our listeners have done along the lines of emergency preparedness when it comes to their finances. If you've taken a step or two and want to share that, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. How about liquid investments? We've talked about stocks and bonds. Anything else along those lines we should be thinking about here?
Most of your investments are pretty liquid. If your financial advisor's office may not be operating, you know, like say, for example, here we may get taken out by a tornado. But for example, at where we are, you can call an 800 number and still talk to someone about your account. And most of your advisors have the same thing. I'm sure Barbara's firm is set up that way. Mm-hmm. So what you can do is you can sell a mutual fund and they settle in 1 or 2 days. You know, you can ACH or electronic funds transfer cash into a bank that you can get to. There are other ways to get to cash pretty quickly. I don't know. I mean, real estate obviously is illiquid, but most of the things you have in a brokerage account, you can tap into cash pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. I had an interesting conversation with a friend from Houston and a financial advisor from Houston within the past week, and his office was flooded badly.
Oh.
And they're all working remotely.
Yeah.
And if you're a business owner, that's something you would want to know beforehand, before the emergency strikes. Are your computer systems adequate to support people working offline? If it's a service industry, mm-hmm. obviously, if you have inventory, you can't pull that off. But that's how our office is set up. Ice storms, everybody takes their computers, nobody comes in. We can do it all remotely.
You know, some folks listening to this might be wondering about putting their personal account information in the cloud, given all the hacks we've had of late. Do you worry about that, Sandy?
Well, I think you need to be careful how you do it. If an email is not as secure as cloud data where you have it password protected and two-step authentication, like a code has to be sent to your phone and then entered before you get in. So that's a pretty secure level of authentication.
Mm-hmm. So that's something to think about.
Yeah, which method you use.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about financial preparedness in case all heck breaks loose and what you should be thinking about. Let's go to some phone calls here. Again, 816-235-2888. Valerie from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
One of the suggestions I'd make in your fire safe is your prescription, the written form, because so many times we get used to doing an automated refill, and if phone lines are down and you have medication, you need that piece of paper to get your medication.
And do you have your doctor give you a duplicate or a couple just so you can store them away, Valerie?
Most doctors can write a script that's good for 1 year. Depending on the medication. Obviously, some controlled substances, that wouldn't work. But if, for example, just like you said, preparing to go on a vacation, if you know a storm is coming, this is something you want to do besides stocking up on bread and toilet paper. You want to get your prescriptions in writing.
That's interesting. I'm just looking down a list of key documents to have, and halfway down the list, Valerie, is this note, prescription drug information. There you go. You've hit a good one there. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Judy from Paola on the Kansas side. Judy, good morning. Nice to have you.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to be here. Hi.
Tell us about what you do to keep your documents safe and what you do.
Right. I worry about tornadoes, so we have a very heavy home safe, and I keep my backup documents in a safety deposit box in our bank, which is an old-fashioned with a huge walk-in vault. Is that considered safe?
Boy, sounds safe to me. Sandy.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah,
someplace off-safe, off-site, that you would be able to access. That's a good idea, Judy.
Okay, I was afraid if the bank's closed or something, but I think you can always get to your safety deposit box. Yes.
Make sure you have that key with you.
You bet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Judy, thank you. There's always something to worry about. You get a safety deposit box, do you have the key? Yeah.
One thing I might mention, if you're using the cloud or the internet to store documents, you know, in the end, what you need is the password to your password manager, because that lets you get to your primary care physician's account where you have your prescriptions written down. It lets you log into your account at your insurance company and print off proof of insurance for whatever you need. So as long as, and if you use a password manager, that one password into that gives you your user ID and password into all those other areas where your information
is. You know, I need to do that. I bet legions of people who are listening to this right now need to do that as well, because I've got a sheet of paper written down with like 9,000 passwords on it, and it's ridiculous.
I know. And if you have that sheet of paper, make sure you have a photocopy, and it's either in the cloud or it's in the little box that you're going to grab when you flee or shelter in place. You know, some kind of plastic, something that's waterproof. So, because you need the passwords too.
Yeah. And do you have a box you're going to grab when you flee, Barbara?
Yeah, we have camping equipment set up in the basement in a certain section. And yeah, we can just pull and go.
Pull and go. Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to some calls here. And Eric from Kansas City, Kansas. Eric, you're on Up to Date. Nice to have you.
Hey, love your show.
Thank you. Listen,
I had a question. Why isn't there more information on this? I love this part of the show. Especially in lieu of all the hurricanes and the earthquakes and so forth, we need to be a little more conscious of, instead of trying to take these big vacations and going to these games and things, we need to take a little time and do just what your show is talking about, you know, disaster preparedness for our families.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it just takes, you know, 2 or 3 hours to set some of these things in place. But Barbara and I were talking before the show that since we both have up close and personal experiences with tornadoes, we always know in the house in which we're living that year where we're going to go.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Eric, to your point, let me give you a couple of the resources that we refer to periodically. The Red Cross has a very nice emergency preparedness checklist. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has some good information. The CDC, which stands for the Center for Disease Control, its website has some good information.
Oh, that's great.
So if you are interested in educating yourself further, we're just kind of doing the highlights, the things that seem obvious to this because we've both been so close to tornadoes. But there are many, many more things, and tornadoes may not be what you're preparing for. It may be a flood or even an earthquake. We're in an earthquake zone. So.
Right, and I'm going to do it, I know, for myself and for my family. I just think people need to wake up a little bit. And everybody talks about all these big vacations, they're taking all these things. Then all of a sudden, when we have something that happened down in Houston or Florida or something, everybody's sitting there with their mouth open, you know, and why wait until something like this happens when you can, you know, what do they say? An ounce of prevention is like a pound of, I forget exactly the term, but you know what I mean. So
You're preaching to the choir here, Eric. I sure appreciate it. I'm glad you called.
Yeah, absolutely.
You bet.
God bless you guys. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. What's your password manager? I'm going to make a note on my script here and go home tonight and think about this.
I use RoboForm, but there's
RoboForm?
Yes, but there's KeePass, there's LastPass, but and actually you're right, you can't remember them all. I have like 140 or 127 entries in mine, and grant you, a lot of those aren't important, but some of those are extremely important.
Does it cost money to do this thing?
There are free versions you can get. I think the RoboForm I pay for is $19 a year.
Yeah, okay. Back to some phone calls here. Kathy from Peculiar, Missouri. Kathy, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I wish somebody had told me it was a good idea to bolt your Sentry FireSafe file box to the floor. 2 years ago, I had a break-in, and that's exactly what they stole. I did not keep any money in there. I kept sentimental things and all of my important records, and I thought that was a good place to keep them. I have since heard people keep those kind of things in a better safe, heavier safe, which is their gun safe. Of course, I don't have one, but sounds like a wish I had.
Yeah, Kathy, thank you. And a good place to bolt your safe to the floor would be where?
I have one bolted in, and I'm not saying.
I was going to say. I'm really getting personal here, and I get that. But you wouldn't do it in your bathroom. You would do it in the closet in the bathroom, in the bedroom, probably.
I know of insurance agents that say the basement is the best place to bolt it. Now, it has to be waterproof. I mean, if you're working from the possibility of a flood,
that's what's going to flood first.
The basement will flood first. And I'm just passing along information that I've heard property and casualty agents give. And they say the basement, Kathy. I don't know if that's useful, but
Yeah. And again, how about some other things you might want to keep, you know, safe? There's a note here about treasured photos, those kinds of things. Jewelry, Barbara, what else?
Those are important things. When you get beyond the what do I need to survive, I think you get to a point of what would I miss? And it would be the photos. So one thing you can do in advance is have them transferred to, you can always do load them up to the cloud, but think about having them transferred to DVD. My grandfather made it wasn't even Super 8, it was 8mm films of us kids when we were very, very young. Mm-hmm. And I had all those put on DVD and distributed to the family. So if mine disappears,
there's backups somewhere.
There are backups, and it's easy to recover. Jewelry, obviously, you want to be able to recover that. If it's lost in a storm, you're going to have some documentation, which you need to keep. But again, that's a good thing to put into that waterproof safe.
Corey offered this password service. A good password manager to mention is 1Password, which has cheap family plans and also includes cloud document storage. Okay.
That's good.
I'm going to write that one down, too, because Steve-O here has got to get his life together. Okay. How about we've been talking about floods and the danger of floods. Let's just talk for a moment about what flood insurance covers and what it doesn't cover, and the same with auto insurance.
Yes. Back to flood insurance. Only about 17% of people in Houston had flood insurance. So if your house was damaged, that's right out of your pocket. And those losses were substantial.
Just 17%.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And anyway, it covers essential systems in your home, like your heater, your air conditioning, covers your appliances, covers carpeting and windows, paneling, wallboard, bookcases, your personal property. What it does not cover is what you're keeping in your basements or your crawl spaces. So you need to be careful where you store what. If you store that jewelry down there, then what?
So flood insurance doesn't cover what's in the basement sometimes.
It doesn't cover contents.
Yes, yeah. In the basements.
Would that be the place where you seemingly need it the most?
Well, if you're thinking tornadoes, that's where you certainly would think.
Yes, yeah, but this is for flooding.
Right.
See, that's what people are worried about when it comes to insurance. There's always like some catch, and you don't know, you're not familiar with the catch sometimes.
Well, let me tell you the other catch. A lot of people believe that standard homeowners and renters insurance will cover flooding. It will not.
Nope.
You have to have a flood policy, and then the flood policy doesn't cover contents, and so you need an additional policy for that. Standard homeowner policies will cover tornadoes, lightning strikes, things like that, but not floods. And after Hurricane Sandy in 2014, new standards were developed on the national level. So there's the National Flood Insurance Program.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to buy it through an agent, and the agent will be very well informed. There's a fascinating map on the NFIP website that you can roll over counties to show how many flood events there are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's federal insurance, but you have to purchase it through an agent. And be sure and ask the agent what the limits in the policy are. Make sure they're high enough to cover you from some kind of a flooding event. I know living in Brookside, that recent series of storms
mm-hmm.
Wiped out a lot of finished basements in my neighborhood, an awful lot.
But again, the flooding would that have helped rebuild your finished basement? Not the contents.
Flood insurance, yes.
Flood insurance would have. Yeah, okay.
But that's too, it's capped at $250,000 per building. A lot of houses are worth more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also $100,000 for contents. And it does not include, if you are displaced, say you're living in a shelter or have to go out of state to a hotel for 3 or 4 weeks, it doesn't include that cost.
Kathleen wants to know what different advice you might offer for renters when it comes to what we're talking about here.
Actually, renters can buy flood insurance.
They can.
If that is her specific question, yes, they mm-hmm. can. You can buy it if you're a homeowner, a renter, or a business owner.
Okay. So there are ways to deal with all that, even if you're a renter out there.
There are. And one of the positives about flood insurance is it pays out even if there is no national disaster declaration. So again, I'm thinking flooding in Brookside. President Trump isn't going to step in and declare that a national disaster, but it sure was in my neighborhood. The flood insurance would have paid out on that.
Yeah. Again, people don't think about flood coverage in our neck of the woods very often, but they should, you're saying.
They should.
Okay. We'll have to leave our good conversation there. I want to thank our Smart Money team for once again coming to the rescue here. Sandy Weaver is a CPA, a certified financial planner with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Thank you both for the good conversation.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that 1/8-cent sales tax that passed in April in this city that will help build up the east side of Kansas City. What should that money be spent on? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, we spoke with a Kansas bicyclist pedaling from Canada to Mexico alongside migrating monarch butterflies. We also learned why some U.S. veterans are being deported. Find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll ask a panel of young people and take callers from our listeners of youth. What exactly does it mean to be an American, and are American adults living up to the country's ideals? That mouthful is tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in April, Kansas City voters approved a 1/8-cent sales tax to bolster a specific part of the city's urban core. The idea of the tax was to balance out development in a city that has focused intently on downtown development in recent years, but not so much on the east side. Now the question is, how will that money be spent, and who gets to decide how it will be allocated? With us to answer these questions is Seft Hunter. He's Executive Director of Communities Creating Opportunity, also known as CCO, that held a meeting last night to talk about the tax. He's also president of the Mannheim Neighborhood Association. Seft, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Good morning.
We're interested in knowing how you think the tax should be spent as well. You can give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Seth, this was a pretty unusual deal, this tax, focused as it is on just one part of the city. How big a deal is this tax for the east side?
Well, I think in essence, we need to understand the Kansas City voters passing this tax in a larger context. So we have a history here in Kansas City of where residents have come out consistently and supported initiatives that really do seek to kind of address social challenges. So this tax was actually just one part of a history of folks here in Kansas City supporting initiative. Now, this specific tax does focus on a part of our community where we've seen, as many of you know, some of the most consistent challenges. In essence, what we find is in these communities, we see some persistent challenges such as high unemployment, poor graduation rates, and just a host of other challenges that in aggregate leads individuals to live sicker and shorter lives. In essence, in these communities, we see on average of a 13 to 15 year difference in life expectancies. Wow. Between different groups. And those differences are seen and observed most significantly between African-American males and white females. So these communities are communities that do face some significant challenges and by extension can most benefit from strategic investments such as the investment of the 8-cent sales tax. Now, it's important to note that this by itself is not going to solve all of our challenges, but it is an important step forward.
Take it just a minute and give us some context here, Seth, this history of social consciousness and awareness that you just referred to. Walk us through that a little bit.
And so, for example, here in Kansas City, we have a health levy that was passed by Kansas City voters. It does provide, $30 million to safety net organizations, a critical resource, to folks who need access to healthcare. Truman Medical Center, for example, is one organization that benefits from that. Other social service and health provision agencies, such as the Kansas City Care Clinic and others, benefit from those resources. We saw just earlier this spring, Kansas City voters going to the polls. Even in light of state preemption, folks passed a minimum wage bill, 76-24, even though folks knew that it faced preemption by the state. And so right. I think those are just a few examples of where, Kansas City voters over time have consistently shown up and have really kind of stepped out there in fairly powerful ways and really kind of, matched their social conscience with policies that help so advance those initiatives.
If our listeners have thoughts on how they think this tax should be spent, we're all ears here this morning. Give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, given all that, Seth, I gather you weren't surprised that this 1/8 cent sales tax for the East Side passed in April.
Well, I mean, I think in essence, the pass and the openness of Kansas City voters to step in moments like this did give it an indication. At the same time, you know, this is a tax that benefit specifically, you know, just one area of the city, but all voters in Kansas City across the broad landscape of Kansas City were asked to weigh in. And so I think that's an important step forward where folks are saying, hey, parts of our city need a little bit more help than others for a particular season. And I think Kansas City voters in their wisdom stepped out and had the willingness to approve this tax.
You know, if this tax is used correctly, what will it do, Seth, and what impact do you hope that it has? What's the hope here?
Yeah, so I think the hope is that we will be able to address some of the challenges. Now, this tax is not going to address all of our challenges. In essence, it projects about $8.6 million per year over 10 years, right? The geography that it focuses in is 9th Street to the north, Gregory to the south, Paseo to the west, and Indiana to the east. So that's a fairly large area.
Yeah.
And so in essence, what we really have to look at is how can we actually catalyze, you know, focus on catalytic investment projects that really builds on strengths that already exist in these communities. But we know that the scope of the challenges that exist in these communities will not cannot be addressed only by these sources of funds.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, Kansas City, Kansas, just a year or so ago, finished paying off some bonds for development of the Legends out on the west side. That resulted in like a $12 million windfall for the community. And on one hand, as you're pointing out here, that sounds like a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the expanse of Wyandotte County, it's a drop in the bucket. And the suggestion here is $8.6 million sounds like a lot over 10 years, $80 million bucks, $90 million bucks. But there's a lot of need out there.
Yeah, there are tremendous needs. And I think while this is an important step forward, I think we have to be really clear as a community that we will be able to address some challenges, but we'll not be able to address them all, right? And I think this really calls for the need for very focused and strategic investment to be able to catalyze these funds to actually attract other source of funds and other investments. And I think without that, we'll be left seeing, you know, this money spent, but not really seeing much outcome from it.
And again, if our listeners have thoughts on how they want to see this money spent, we're really looking for your thoughts today. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. This notion of spurring other investment that you're talking about here, give us some examples of what you might be talking about and how real it is that the East Side can achieve some of these.
Yeah, well, I think one of the what we've seen with the ballot initiative that actually led to the passage of the creation of this pot of money was that it did not include a plan. So it wasn't like voters did not vote on a specific plan. And I think that
again is pretty unusual.
Which is pretty unusual. But again, it speaks to the commitment of voters in Kansas City to really kind of step out and support initiatives like this. Now, in the absence of a plan, I think it now is left to the committee and the city council to be able to come up with a set of criteria that I really do think that I think really should build on some of the areas and opportunities that already exist in this community. And I think we really have to look at targeted and strategic investment if we're going to see these funds actually make a discernible difference. We're at the end of 10 years, we're able to look back and see where there are clear signs of progress, clear kind of forward movement in this broad geography that is covered by the funds.
And when you say targeted strategic investment, an example of that would be what? Just in layman's terms, we can all hang with you here.
Absolutely. And I think an example of that is to look at, for example, the corner of 27th and Prospect and Linwood, right there in the Linwood Shopping Center area. We see new grocery store going in. We see
a trouble spot for a long time.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the areas in the community that we see the highest violence. One of the areas in the community where we see young males of color at elevated risk for premature death by death by gunshot wounds. Right. And so we do see some important development taking place right there at a critical area of our community. So I think that would be one example that would be kind of like a critical node where some additional investment can be catalyzed to actually make a clear and discernible difference.
Like what kind of thing might go in there that would address what you're talking about?
Yeah. So when we look at some of the challenges that exist in this community, we know that folks, face significant challenges accessing healthy food, for example. So opportunities where we're able to address food access is going to be an important step forward. We know that individuals have to travel significant distances, for example, to access healthcare. Right. Mm-hmm. So opportunities where we're able to kind of localize those services and increase accessibility to critical services would be one such example. We know that, in order for retail to really take root, we need to increase and repopulate these communities. So I think strategies that lead to, attracting new residents and developing a stronger base for, retail development and things like that would be important steps forward.
I want to go back to the food desert idea because, again, so many communities across the country face that concern. Kansas City, Missouri certainly does. Kansas City, Kansas has for many years. The unified government on the Kansas side has actually invested in grocery stores, handed over checks to grocery stores to build in their communities, and they've had a lot of success with it. Is that what you're looking at on the Missouri side as well, saying, Mr. Grocery Store Manager, we'll give you a check to come build help you build a grocery store right here in this neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
Because the per capita income in these neighborhoods oftentimes isn't enough, at least according to the grocery store people, to maintain a store in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, and I think we know that folks in this community face significant challenges with having reliable access to economic opportunity, and poverty is just a reality of life in these communities. But we also know that food is one of those critical resources where, it's something that all of us need, right? And so it's not a luxury wherein we're asking for, high-end retail to be located in these communities.
It's a grocery store.
Yeah, we ask for critical resources that, irrespective of poverty, folks need access to healthy foods. Now, I do think we have to have a broader sense of how we address this food access issue. And I think grocery stores are one potential pathway. I think we also have to look at more kind of organic, more grassroots opportunities, such as urban farming and other opportunities to help kind of address this need. We know that large grocery stores use sometimes prohibitive metrics to that really limit their willingness to locate in these communities. And I think if we're waiting on that to be the only solution, then, we're going to be waiting for some time. Now, I think we have to be more broad and more expansive in looking at alternative models of how we're going to address food access. And I think adding grocery stores to the community is just one potential pathway.
Seth Hunter is my guest. He's executive director of Communities Creating Opportunity, known as CCO. We're talking about that 1/8 cent sales tax that voters approved in April to help develop the east side of Kansas City. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Again, you talked a few minutes ago, to Seth, about attracting residents to the area. Sounds like a simple idea, but that's tough. That's hard to do in neighborhoods that have struggled for as many years as some of these neighborhoods have.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And but we are seeing some early progress, especially as we look immediately east of Truce. We see communities not too far from where we sit, just a few blocks from, just a few blocks north of 47th Street and Truce. We see communities all along Truce going from about 47th Street to about 22nd Street. Many of those communities have begun to see kind of significant repopulation. I think
that's a huge step, right?
Absolutely.
That's a big change from where we've been.
Absolutely. But we need to see, we need to see that continue to grow. Now, we know that.
What's causing that? What's stimulating that repopulation?
Well, I think it's just a change in sensibility. So especially as we look at, the millennial generation, I mean, their sensibilities as far as like not wanting to spend a lot of time in the car, wanting to be closer to like the museum and other things that are associated with, consistent with the kind of social life that they want to live. And then also the opportunity that we have just a significant and strong housing stock in East of Truce communities, whereas many of these homes were built at the turn of the century. They have, a lot of historic charm. And then folks can also still acquire them and get a great deal. So folks are able to acquire a really nice house and not be in debt for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that presents some important opportunities. And I think also, too, when we consider here in Kansas City, we look at Troost Avenue, many of us look at Troost Avenue as a prohibitive barrier. But, you know, millennial generations see that as important, but not prohibitive. So millennials are a lot more open to moving east of Troost and being located within the urban landscape. Now, we also know that local
government... I just love millennials. There's so many things about them I like, and you're just laying out a few of them. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, also municipal government can pursue strategies that help to spur this. So, for example, mm-hmm. one potential tool that we've seen used to great effect is to actually use tax abatement structure, right? Mm-hmm. So for folks who are willing to move into these communities, you know, we could see basically tax incentives or tax abatement can be a powerful tool. We also know...
Do those abatements already exist, Seth? Because goodness knows we give lots of tax breaks to developers, even in the plaza area around town. Can residents get a tax break for moving into certain communities?
Well, we know that municipal government can use tax abatement over a specific geography to limit, to abate taxes for a period of time. And we know that that has been a powerful inducement to getting individuals to move into a community.
Yeah.
But what we see, as you pointed out, is that oftentimes that when we look at where those taxes are likely to be abated, it goes to the individuals with the greatest access and the greatest power to be able to get to advocate for those abatements. And we need to see more of those abatements being located in East of Troost communities.
We just have a few minutes left, so I want to get to a couple of other points here. Talk to me a little bit about the bureaucratic structure that's been set up for how people are going to decide how this money is going to be spent. Because you've already alluded to a committee and to the city council. What is this committee you're talking about? Who appoints it, and when does it begin to meet?
Yeah, so there is a committee. There is an oversight committee that was the kind of the language that created that structure was located in the actual petition that voters passed earlier this spring. And it is a 5-member board where 3 of the individuals are appointed by the mayor, one person is appointed by the school district, and another is appointed by the county.
Okay.
Those appointments have been made, and the board will be seated early October.
Is the tax being collected now?
The tax will begin to be collected October 1st. And
okay,
as you might expect, it'll take some time to build up the pot.
Well, that's my birthday. So we're going to begin collecting the tax on my birthday.
That's right. Start shopping.
There you go. And so that money will begin to build up, and then this committee will come along, and it will make the decisions as to how the dollars get allocated here then, right?
Yeah, so the committee will make the recommendations, but the Kansas City Council would be the group that has the final say.
Okay, last night, your group, CCO, Communities Creating Opportunity, held a town hall meeting of sorts, if I understand correctly, mm-hmm. to talk about how this tax is going to work and how the money is going to be spent. What kind of turnout did you have? What kind of responses did you get from people about what they want to see here?
Yeah, and so typically CCO is an organization that convenes residents around issues like this. And in essence, part of what last night's conversation was about was really to kind of hear what are the concerns and aspirations of community members as well as it pertains to being able to kind of shape a vision for how these funds should be distributed. And as you might guess, we heard like significant concern because this is not the first time that we've had, you know, kind of opportunities for investment in these communities. And in the past, you know, the outcome has not always been, you know, kind of consistent with our shared desires. And so folks, you know, many folks kind of came to this to the conversation last night with both hope as well as concerns as far as ensuring that, hey, what will make this time different? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be really clear and honest that the only thing that will make this time different is really us as residents being really clear about our requests and also being consistent in our advocacy to ensure that there is specific and clear accountability for how these funds are spent.
People were asking specifically about what kinds of projects. What were they laying out that they'd like to see happen? A grocery store, for instance, maybe.
Yes. And so I think what folks were really, really spoke to last night was they wanted to see at the end of the 10 years clear, discernible progress in these communities, right? I think.
Which begins to speak to focused concentration of money being spent in certain areas so you can actually see a difference.
Yes. So they basically wanted to focus on things that are going to actually move move the needle by way of when you drive to these communities in 10 years, you can clearly see where the money was invested in ways that actually catalyze and help to grow and attract additional resources.
And again, things like what, Seth?
So things like grocery stores, things like access to healthcare, things mm-hmm. like, you know, access to other critical services that are currently not located in this community. Folks were highly concerned about ensuring that we have, for example, an increased minority participation rate, where smaller, you know, kind of minority-owned businesses and folks that have been located and have been working in these communities also get the opportunity to participate in, you know, kind of leading some of the projects that will come from this initiative. That was a significant concern that was repeated consistently last night.
Do you know, can this committee recommend that money be borrowed ahead of the time it's collected? Is that a possibility here, or has that idea been broached?
You know, I'm not sure about that, just to be completely honest.
Yeah, right.
But I think in essence, we know that it's going to take some time for that pool to build up. And that actually presents a really strong opportunity to ensure that the folks that are charged with oversight of these funds can actually go out and spend some time really listening and really looking strategically across this broad landscape to identify where are the areas, what are the projects that can be most catalytic. Part of my concern when you look at the composition of this board, absent from the kind of list of qualifications of individuals who are on this board, are, you know, there's not an urban planner. There's not sufficient capacity, for mm-hmm. example, about folks who actually lead public financing of public projects. And I think, you know, while I think the board can access those, you know, kind of consultants to help shape their understanding of those initiatives, it is, in fact, a concern that those qualifications were not included on the board.
Just quickly, I'm almost out of time. How transparent is this process going to be?
Well, all these meetings will be public. Mm-hmm. All these meetings will be public. We as an organization in CCO will post these meetings on our Facebook page and on our website, and we'll actually drive residents to attend these meetings. So all these meetings will be public, required of public notification, and will be held in ways that any resident of Kansas City and the region can attend.
That's Seth Hunter. He's Executive Director of Communities Creating Opportunity, otherwise known as CCO. Seth, thanks for the good update. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Prasky. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a panel of teens about American ideals and whether we adults are living up to them. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Prasky, and you are up to date.